Andrew Wilder, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So you have this background in humanitarian and development programs and kind of leading those efforts. What would you say over the past many years is the primary humanitarian and development activity or need in Afghanistan?
Well, it's really evolved. I mean, I started working in Afghanistan in 1986 based in Pakistan, but running some of the refugee programs and cross-border programs into Afghanistan. And so I spent quite a bit of time working on refugee humanitarian aid programs, both for refugees in Pakistan as well as in Afghanistan, including during the very, difficult time during the Taliban rule, where as director of Save the Children, so trying to run, women and child-focused programs in Afghanistan was challenging and yet still a lot of, good work could be done even in that context. But then after 9/11, everything changed, and the real focus then became on how to rebuild the country and much more ambitious state-building agendas, and how to rebuild the devastated health sector, education sector. So the last 10 years, 12 years, that you've seen a big change in focus to longer-term development programs as opposed to the humanitarian work we saw earlier.
So you've moved really from kind of like relief services to really trying to provide them some infrastructure, schools, hospitals, healthcare, general, assistance for their development over the long haul.
Yeah, and that certainly was the objective. Is again, before the level of resources were tiny, and it was mostly focusing on life-saving kind of interventions. There were education programs and health programs, but very small in nature. And so now it's been how to rebuild the systems and the system, for the health delivery in Afghanistan and education. And I think there there's lots of bad news on Afghanistan in the headlines these days, but I think it's really important to recognize just what has been achieved. And as someone who's working there in the 80s and 90s, it's phenomenal to me what has been accomplished. And to me, I think the best example of that is in the health sector, where when I was working there in the 90s, the average life expectancy was believed to be about 42 years of age in Afghanistan, one of the lowest in the world. And today, a decade or so more later, it's 62. And that's largely due to very impressive reductions in maternal mortality rates and in particular infant mortality rates. And I mean, that's one fantastic story coming out of Afghanistan that often doesn't get told amongst all the gloom and doom news from Afghanistan. So amongst a lot of the problems, and again, many of us who've been working there are disappointed that more wasn't achieved and there's been problems of corruption and other things. But it's important not to lose sight that there have been tremendous gains.
Well, I think that's such an important point because, as you said, so much of what we hear is doom and gloom. And so the narrative about Afghanistan is, oh, my gosh, you can't go there. It's a terrible place. It's dangerous. It's difficult. Everybody dies. But it sounds like that what has been done on the ground. So and to kind of connect that to this notion of effectiveness of aid of this sort, I mean, it sounds like it's really worked. There have been major success stories of aid and development projects that have really resulted in good news.
Yes, and there is definitely good news. And of course, there's bad news. And I think that's where, a lot of the research I was doing a few years ago at Tufts University was showing about how some of the aid wasn't spent effectively. And my main focus then was on the efforts to use development aid to promote our stabilization and security objectives in Afghanistan. And the conclusion I reached there was that actually, in that context, development aid wasn't very effective in bringing security to the country, but actually it was quite effective in achieving development objectives. But I think that's where one of the problems, I think, in terms of U.S. development aid is increasingly it's legitimate. We fund development funding because we think we'll achieve security objectives, for which I think it's not terribly effective. But we don't value it sufficiently for achieving the development objectives, for which it is, I think, quite effective.
Right, the human security objective as opposed to the state security,
exactly,
or security of the region or the rest of the world. So maybe we could move to something that you're also working on, and we're looking forward to some upcoming elections in the country in Afghanistan, and maybe moving from the development to more of the state building. Is that where we see more of the doom and gloom? Can we be optimistic at all? I mean, what can we expect in this upcoming election?
Well, there is a lot of fear in Afghanistan about what's going to happen with the upcoming transitions. I mean, one transition is the security transition from international forces to complete handing over that authority to Afghan forces, and that's well underway and is scheduled to be fully completed by the end of 2014. There's also going to be an economic transition where we've had lots of money pouring into Afghanistan. And as a lot of the troops pull out, a lot of the resources are going to be pulled out with it. And so we're going to go from big economic transition. And, you know, this is where I would caution, as someone who used to criticize we were trying to actually spend too much money in Afghanistan, let's not go from that extreme to the extreme of spending too little. Because, I mean, if you created this war and aid economy bubble, you know, the key is don't pop the balloon, you know, let the air out of the balloon in a controlled manner. So I think managing that economic transition is going to be critical. But to me, the most important transition in terms of future peace and stability in Afghanistan is going to be the political transition in 2014 from President Karzai to hopefully an elected successor. So in April, presidential elections are scheduled. And it's very important, I think, that those go forward, that they are credible elections and produce a legitimate outcome, or else it's unclear what is going to be the glue that holds the country together. Because as much as, you know, President Karzai has had his flaws and problems, ultimately he was a legitimately elected president, and no one's really contesting that other than the Taliban. But if we end up with no legitimate presidents to succeed him, you could see, and a lot of Afghans are fearful, that they could things could disintegrate and head back into outright civil war.
So obviously there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty going on here. I mean, in many different directions, politically, economically, security, transition. I mean, all of this stuff leading to uncertainty. But what are the prospects that you're as you talk about Karzai, you know, stepping down? I mean, are the prospects pretty good that we're going to be able to have a solid transition politically in this country? And then how will that relate to, you know, because most of us are look at this country and understand that it isn't a country where the president really governs, the government really governs all of Afghanistan. I mean, what is the prospect for that changing as we enter these additional transitions?
I've worked in Afghanistan long enough to know that it's very dangerous to make predictions. often my predictions are wrong, I hasten to add. I think there are many challenges, and it's going to be a very difficult transition. I think one of the things that gives me hope is that actually so many of the political elites in Afghanistan have benefited so tremendously from the last decade that they have much more stake in ensuring that things don't return to civil war. And so that's what gives me some hope that they will collectively work to try to ensure it'll probably be a messy process, but that ultimately there will be an elected successor to Karzai that they can all agree to support and get something in return. I mean, I think it's going to be a lot of deal making and patronage being distributed to try to, you know, winners, you know, trying to accommodate losers so that they stay on side. So I think this is what a lot of Afghans are currently actually debating, is even if the election doesn't go terribly well, how can we get an agreement among some of the main candidates contesting not to let this lead to, again, a return to civil war? Because then everyone would lose from that.
And so I have to imagine that the United States is not just going to completely withdraw from this situation, that there would still be some engagement here on these issues, particularly kind of, you know, overseeing elections, engage, I mean, not, the U.S. and others, for that matter, so that, you know, it isn't, as you mentioned, kind of the balloon is just popped, everybody just runs away, but that there's a real kind of engagement process that will lead to hopefully some sort of stability in the future?
I certainly hope so. And that certainly was the commitment that the U.S. and the international community made when we went in fall of 2001, which is where, you know, we abandoned Afghanistan once before and when the Soviets withdrew and it, you know, came back to haunt us and hurt Afghanistan tremendously and Afghans in particular. But we made promises that this time we won't do that again, because they realized that if all international troops left, it would be very difficult to see how the Afghan National Security Forces that we've invested tens of billions of dollars in creating could sustain themselves. They're not ready yet to stand on their own. They are ready to do the lion's share of the fighting, and they're already doing that. But, you know, the support systems, the training systems, you know, maintaining all the equipment they've been provided, all these kind of details are still going to take time to develop their capacity. But also psychologically, it's not just support to the military forces. It's the psychological importance of international forces remaining behind. And if the Americans make a commitment, then the NATO allies will follow suit. If the Americans decide to go to the zero option, as it was being discussed, then our NATO allies would also not be able to stay on in Afghanistan. So I think that's for Afghans. they're really concerned that if all troops leave, things will fall apart.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the psychological impact of this. And I mean, because, you know, the reality is that as international forces and American forces withdraw and that assistance goes away and Afghans have to take, you know, more responsibility for their own country, is that that perhaps will open up some sort of opportunity for other players to come in to the arena that perhaps aren't going to be as helpful. And perhaps will detract from the gains that have been made in Afghanistan.
And I think that's the dilemma for Afghans is, you know, a lot of Afghans don't like the fact that there's foreign troops that have come into their country and that they're dependent on them. However, they are in a difficult neighborhood with, you know, Pakistan to the east, you know, Iran to the south, some Tajikistan, others of the stans in the north, and you know, other, you know, interference in the internal affairs there. So there is this concern that if the U.S. withdraws, they'll be at the mercy of their neighbors.
Their neighbors. I mean, and that's, yeah, that's somewhat of a reality, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's
absolutely,
you know, not just a perception, but a reality. And
oh,
so
no,
just I've, having that again, that perception of that assistance is going to be critical for their own psychology.
Yeah, and already that psychology is having an impact. I mean, you know, there's a report last year, something like $8 billion of capital flight out of Afghanistan. The Afghans are moving some of their money out because of the uncertainty of what's going to happen. I know a lot of Afghans those who have the option are trying to move some of their families out of Afghanistan and are preparing exit strategies. I was just in Afghanistan a few weeks ago and heard a very poignant story about a media organization with lots of young men and women working in it, and many of them were postponing their marriage, which is a big deal in that part of the world, until after 2014, because there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen next year.
Well, I think that's what's so fascinating about it, is that we just don't know exactly where this is headed. And so the uncertainty, the volatility, you know, all of these things coming together. But it sounds like the groundwork has been laid. And if that balloon isn't just popped and we can let that air out slowly, as you say, which is a wonderful metaphor, that you know, we can see them continue on the right track.
We could. And I do think that that's where the U.S. really does need to be forceful in reiterating time and again its long-term commitment to remain engaged in Afghanistan, and not at the levels that we were, but in a sustainable level moving forward, that we're not going to abandon Afghanistan. And yes, from my perspective, a longer-term commitment of some troops in Afghanistan, both for the political and psychological reasons I mentioned, but also for the important security reasons, because we've invested a lot of blood and treasure in Afghanistan. And I think to protect that investment now, let's not, again, go down to zero, and let's reassure Afghans that we're there for the long haul.
Yeah, protecting that investment, certainly a lesson learned from the past, hopefully. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today on Worldview. Such an interesting part of the world, and I appreciate your sharing your thoughts about it.
Thank you for having me.